Yeah, that's a really powerful question.
That's a beautiful question.
That's a very wise question,
Lauren.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with poet Jory Mickelson about All This Divide, a collection that circles our contemporary world in crisis. Pandemics, environmental collapse, war, unfettered consumption, these big themes are placed in the big landscape of the West, its histories and its legacies. Jory, thank you so much for joining me. Welcome to The Right Question.
Thank you for having me.
In All This Divide, you are returning to many of the themes and images you wrote about in your first collection, Wilderness Kingdom, intersections of nature, landscape, queerness, desire, and a lot of history. Will you talk about the relationship between these two books? They seem, to me, in my reading, kind of part and parcel of a larger whole.
Sure. When I was writing Wilderness Kingdom, it was sort of poems that seemed to coalesce together across the body of my work. I had just written poems and had a giant pile, and the first book sort of came out of that. Mm. And with All This Divide, I had the title right away.
Where did that come from?
I don't know.
Just came to you.
Yeah. It's like, I had All This Divide right away, and then I Googled it to see if there were any other books, you know, with that title. I was like, oh, there's not. So I tucked that in my back pocket, and I thought about all of the division and maybe the polarization that we see happening, or divisiveness among relationships, and also like the divides in like the views of the West, and it felt like maybe I was too close to a lot of that in contemporary news or politics, and so I went looking into history to sort of see what happened 100 years ago, what happened 150 years ago. And as I was looking, I realized that many of the topics that we're dealing with today, they were dealing with 150 years ago in sort of these divisive, polarizing sorts of ways. And so, you know, looking at history became my way of extrapolating or exploring what was happening in contemporary life for us now.
You said that you were too close to what was happening. What do you mean by that?
I feel like since we are in the middle of our contemporary lives, getting a distance or an objectivity, you know, it's very difficult for me to like go through a 24-hour news cycle when something big happens, and then a day later step outside this and be, how will they view this in 50 years?
Right. Like it's hard to get that perspective.
Yeah, I have my opinion, but it's limited to the present state of circumstances. So I don't have that clarity, but I can really look to the past and read in the individual voices of the time and sort of reflect on our similarities and our differences.
When you realized that so much of our present moment is mirroring or is repeating itself in the way that it has happened in the past here in the American West, in the Rocky Mountain West, did that allow you a different perspective on the present? Did it make you feel differently about this time that we're living in?
I think it did. It gave me sort of I don't want to say a longevity, but I realized that some of these core issues aren't as immediate or contemporary as we believe that they are. Like, we have never had to deal with like unfettered capitalism before. But then if you look at the past and you see like the Copper Kings or, you know, like industrialism or any of the, like the barons, cattle, lumber, like we were absolutely dealing with
that extreme growth was happening at that point,
right,
too.
And the disparity of income or the conflict between like corporations and government, especially here in Montana. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, it's happening again.
Right.
And that concerns me. That heightens, you know, my awareness of like, it's happening again. But it also takes the edge off a little bit because it's happening again. And I can look to the past and said, we made it through it. We might make it through it again.
Hmm. for our listeners' sakes, we've been kind of talking a little generally or broadly about what this book is about, these divides, these polarizations. I'd like to talk about a specific poem, Beautiful Country. Would you mind reading it?
A little background on Beautiful Country. Beautiful Country conflates Meriwether Lewis's trip with the Lewis and Clark expedition and killing two Blackfeet in one of his excursions and then fleeing. And I've made a fictional place called Two Heart Butte for the poem. It's actually called Heart Butte, and it's named for a different reason. But in my head, before I had like dug into the research, my head had sort of put this together, this story, and so I just went with it. Beautiful country. Oh, beautiful. Oh, country. I didn't want to love all your green, but I let myself. How beauty folds in on the heart before you even begin to know it. I thought, yes, I would kill the one who tried to take this place from me, if it were mine. How I never thought I could commit to beauty with such violence. And how, given our violent histories, no naming can save us. Two Heart Butte, so much wonder a single heart couldn't hold it, but named in truth for two Blackfoot men Meriwether Lewis murdered. How the history of loss sets up a people to either forget or hold on forever. How beauty dares us to change our minds. Perhaps the earth can allow what's been placed deep to be not buried, but maybe called to rest instead. And how what is resting can fold in on itself as it begins to dream of embracing you and everyone who meets us at this rise. I would call this shrinking space between us home.
Hmm. The history of loss sets up a people to either forget or hold on forever. I feel like that line is so telling of this work as a whole. I have a drafted question here, Jory, but I want to hang on to this idea that this poem is taking a history and fictionalizing it for the purpose of this poetry. What is the poet's responsibility to a history when they're writing directly into it and then choosing then to fictionalize it?
Sure. I think Richard Hugo in The Triggering Town says, we don't owe the factual truth anything, but we owe the emotional truth of the poem everything. And Robert Wrigley was one of my primary teachers for my MFA program, and he preached that to us again and again. And so much in the same way when I would write a poem from maybe some biographical material about my own life, I change things. So people would say, you know, did that really happen to you? And I said, no, it's a poem. But emotionally, I try to come as close to the bone as possible.
Mm-hmm. This difference between, as you put it, emotional truth, or Hugo put it, an emotional truth and fact. There's a vast difference there.
Correct. And it's a complicated issue. I don't mean any disrespect or to try and like cover up anyone's bad behavior by it. But I had driven, I think I was driving to Browning, and I went through and I saw Heart Butte, and it was so gorgeous. And I was like, I can absolutely see why I would never give this place up. It's so gorgeous. Like, I just remember being on the front line and in like this glorious early summer, and I was like, you know, it's one of the most beautiful places I've ever been. And that love, that immediately love of the landscape just filled me. And I was fiercely, and I was like, and I saw Heart Butte. And then I remember, and so things sort of conflated in my mind. And the poem had started to write itself before I had gone back and like looked up the facts. And so for me, that seizing up and that joy of the beauty of the land sort of filled me. And so that was the immediate response for the poem.
Yeah, the beauty forced you to, what, hold on forever?
Yeah.
For our listeners' sake, there is a note section at the back of the book in which you address some of these, I'll say, dissonances between the history of this West, this region, and the way that you've written about it.
Absolutely.
Here. Yeah. Did you feel that necessary
just to,
again, this kind of responsibility to the actual history versus the emotional truth of
it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. in this collection, because I did read so much history, I felt a great responsibility to get the facts correct, or as closely to correct as we have them now. Mm-hmm. You know, in some accounts, only the victors of a conquest have the written history, and so that's what we have to go on. Yeah. So for me, getting things as factually as possible in the notes section was important.
Yeah.
And then we let art do what it does.
Sure. So this poem speaks directly to this erasure of a landscape, a history, which throughout your book and throughout our history here has meant the erasure of many, many people. There is this mythos that you're addressing of westward expansion. There's a tension between that expansion and this claiming of home, this idea of beauty. You grew up here in Montana. How do you, Jory, perhaps this book of poetry is the answer to this question, but how do you reconcile the history of this landscape with your familial claiming of this place as home?
That's a big question. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I ever can reconcile it, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I mean, my art is an attempt to reconcile all the questions I have about life and place and relationship. And so I don't think I'll ever get it perfectly. You know, I've started drafting new poems that ask similar questions in new ways. And so I feel like this book is an attempt to ask the questions about our contemporary life in the West, as people who, you know, I'm like fourth or fifth generation in Montana, and there's people who are like hundreds of generations in Montana.
Yeah.
And so, you know, how does my story fit in with all the other stories that have come before and all the stories that are going to come after mine? Mm-hmm. And so that was the central tension for the book, is like, how in a multiplicity of voices do we find a way to tell our own stories without necessarily co-opting someone else's story or pretending it doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm. You've included a series of poems in this collection, Plunder Poems, many of them referencing directly images of tools, tools for digging, like a shovel, for instance, or tools for or of violence and assimilation, a revolver, boarding schools. Tell me about the series and how you conceived of it and its role in this collection.
Sure. One of the things that struck me deeply about the history is when I got into it is how violent it is, how utterly violent it is. You know, lynchings, murder, robbery, genocide, like just endlessly violent. And it became a fraught thing for me because it's part of the history, but how do I navigate in talking about these things and telling some of these stories without co-opting someone else's voice or someone else's story that I don't get to tell? And the other thing that happened too is like, I don't want an account to like glorify someone's trauma. So that becomes the other balance. And so what happened was in sitting with a lot of this, like, how in the heck am I going to write about these subjects? I visited museums and the pieces that I saw in the museum started speaking to me. Mm-hmm. And so the answer seemed to come that I would let the voice of an inanimate object tell a story in its own voice to talk about the things. And that way it didn't co-opt anyone else's story as much as possible. So a shovel can talk about digging for gold in Bannock. So you know, these sorts of things where like the shovel has its own concerns. The shovel has its own anxiety that's
sure.
happening to it. And so I let some of these objects or structures or markers serve as the talking points for exploring different aspects of plunder, different aspects of like that violent upheaval that happens when one people displaces another, when one concern displaces another, again and again.
I love that because I think there's maybe a habit of reading a book of poetry from the lyric eye perspective. And these plunder poems sort of add to what you've already called this kind of polyvocal nature of these histories and this collection.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. Will you read another poem, Jory?
Sure.
Will you read A River Is?
Sure.
Yeah.
A River Is. A river is a prayer of its own making. I don't know what water prays to. Amid those mumbled sentiments, we resisted and surrendered our bodies, as Naaman did to the idea of the ordinary. But we relished in our everyday forms, the common wet, the unremarkable sun who rose mute and unblemished each August morning. My mother, I watched her at this distance. She never appeared more beautiful than with her arms outstretched, almost dancing, her whole self worshiping the current. O river, let me always remember the trivial that goes unmarked. And if remembering can be a prayer in this smallness, let me grow broad, a river at flood.
How do you consider poetry an act of faith? Where does poetry meet prayer for you?
I feel that they, to borrow the definition from another poet, that poetry is an agnostic's prayer. Poetry for me is always an art form that I serve and that I sort of strive to do my best in, my best attempts, my best working of the craft, my best vision. And so for me, I feel like anything that we enter into very deeply or deeply passionately becomes its own sort of spirituality for us. It could be knitting, it could be long distance running, it could be a multiplicity of things for different people. And so for me, poetry is sort of, I mean, some people might call it idolatry, but I, when I look at poetry, I like it continues to engage and call me and ask me to do better every time that I enter into it. And so I take that commitment really seriously.
Am I hearing you that that's where poetry and praise, they overlap? You know, you're still, these attempts that you're talking about, this effort, you're putting those efforts forth in both of these worlds?
Poetry for me isn't like an extension of my spirituality. It's much in the same way that I'm serving the art. And so maybe I'm bivocational in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But poetry is often how I make sense of the world. And so there's beautiful overlaps for me, but they are very distinct.
Yeah.
Because poetry asks for me to be unrestrained in a way, to let the imagination to go where it will, to let like the darkest things in the heart out.
You're listening to A Conversation with Jory Mickelson. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Montana Book Company, located in downtown Helena, Montana since 1978, offering new books for all ages, vinyl records, and community activism. Delivery in Helena and shipping online at mtbookco.com.
I want to note the mention of mother in this poem, and I want to come back to mother, but we'll pivot back around,
okay,
or we'll come back around to it. There are a number of poems in this collection that make use of the prefix un, unmarked in the poem you just read, elsewhere, unsorrow, unblankets, unfolding, unable. Talk through, Jory, the significance of negation in your work, or in this work in particular, creating meaning by writing about what something is not.
I could say it has something to do with a negative capability where you're resting in something and not striving after the answers, like Keats would say. But also, there's a specific path in theology and spirituality called via negativa, mm-hmm, which is the way we know the divine or the sacred is by naming what it is not.
Yeah.
Because it's so, so other, we can't name it, but we can tell you what it is not.
And
so
emphatic, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we would say things like, not bad, not vengeful, not envious. Like,
sure.
You know, and so, yeah, so I feel in some way that tendency, because I find life most often to be completely incomprehensible, joyful, sorrowful, overwhelming, boring, like like that often it's easier to name what something is not rather than what it is.
You write in a poem titled The Drifter Left in the Night, you write, "In the rough-cut church, serious women plow the day with their prayers, spade hard their narrow way toward God. To know what they loved, they left it. Only in absence could they tell its true shape." You also write a poem, "When God Wasn't God." So I really did feel what you've been talking about. I want to take another moment. Would you read another poem, Jory?
Sure.
Would you read Friday Night Bannock?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Friday Night Bannock. Because the cowboy asks me to, I rise. In the smoke-filled room, we greet shyly, as at the start of courtship. Hats tip back on our heads, moons behind a cloud of hair. Then we step hard through the fiddle's unremitting saw, the press box's exhalation, a song that raises our feet despite the long hours in the saddle or the mine. Work that's given us our rough hands, but these hands can't offer relief with such delicate maneuvers. The failure of women to appear, the ones we left at home across the country who love us or will someday. We will build toward that hour of square wooden buildings, window glass, lace, where a woman is fit to be seen. We increase our speed as the tempo builds and the rollicking of our bodies pressed like slices of roughneck bread, sandwiching the tune between us, our sweat sluicing us in salt, in musk, in cheap liquor coming out our pores. The man who asks is the man who leads over the rise of the melody swelling. Each step stamps our desire into the gapped boards of the floor. We shed nearly all at the spin. The work and what this way of living's made us.
I love the energy of this poem. It sort of allows, or it allowed me as the reader, but allows readers to kind of forget, even for the length of the poem, what they're doing in Bannock in the first place and how this narrative sort of fits into the larger narrative of your book. Can you contextualize what's happening in this poem? It's part of a history.
Sure.
That you're speaking to.
Sure. Bannock was temporarily the state's center, or the territory center, the territorial capital. Mm-hmm. And there was a gold rush, and thousands of men showed up, and it became sort of the nexus of activity in this part of the West. And good people came and bad people came, or there's not good and bad people, but in a largely—
People with different motivations.
People with different motivations. That's great. People fleeing the Civil War from both sides. Mm-hmm. People who were just looking to make a future for themselves. People who were trying to swindle people who are making a future for themselves. Mm-hmm. Everyone sort of came to this place where great wealth was promised. And human nature being what it was, in an isolated place, largely without civilization, as we might call it, the rule of law, the rule of civility, it consisted of like mining claims, brothels, and bars mostly.
Mm-hmm.
So within that context, that became like a 24-hour hive of activity that just went on and on, and people, their best and worst natures came out in that landscape.
And yet women were seriously lacking in this landscape.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in part of reading in the West, they would often hold these dances in which the men had to play both roles. And sometimes the men who asked would lead, or the men who were substituting the place of women would tie a handkerchief to the front of their like pants to signify that they were in the ladies' role for the dance. And they had these big dances.
Was that something you knew before kind of digging into the research of this book?
I knew that there was a lot of male activity happening in the West for the lack of women, yes.
Sure, sure. Fathers were a really prevalent part of your previous collection, Wilderness Kingdom, in the sense of their mention anyway. And here, as I kind of alluded to earlier, mothers and women, sisters are mentioned throughout. What are you trying to say or like elicit by bringing these women into the text in the way that you have?
Sure. I think the response that you're noticing. In my first book, I had a lot of poems about father figures, and I didn't really mention my mother or the speaker's mother or women in general. And that became something that I was very aware of from the first book. And so I wanted to make sure that those voices sort of imaginatively started speaking to me. Mm. And some of the feedback I had gotten in that same vein of like, oh my gosh, you know, like you had such a hard childhood. I mean, like the speaker of the poem went right through these various scenarios, and I felt a little bad for my dad, to be honest. Because, oh, I mean, you know, people will hear a poet read like terrible father poems and then they're like, I'm so
sorry.
What'd
you do?
Yeah, like, so I felt like as a corrective and also as to like having many father poems in that first book that there was an absence of women or female voices. And there was also like, I didn't want to have the same sort of focus on the authoritative father figure for the speakers in these poems.
I'm curious about the difference in the types or the ways in which you've written about masculinity then in these two books. How would you compare the two?
Sure. I was raised in rural Montana, and so I was also raised in a sort of conservative area. And so the role models that were put forward to me of masculinity and what it meant to be a man were, you know, very set, you know. And so, you know, as I came into adulthood, for me, I had to find what attributes I wanted to keep and which I wanted to discard for myself. And so I think some of those concerns are pretty present in Wilderness Kingdom. And as life has continued, I mean, many of the poems, the book Wilderness came out in 2019.
Yeah.
And so the oldest of those poems are about 10 years old. So we're looking at 2009.
Yeah, wow.
Versus, you know, 2024, or I think 2020 is when I had finished All This Divide, or mm-hmm. 2021.
Okay.
And so you have this decade, at least, of sort of change that happened to me as a person moving through life. And
sure.
So, you know, and part of that is as a non-binary person is sort of like, where do we float between sort of these poles or on this spectrum, and you know, what kind of qualities do I want to embody, and are those attached to gender? Are those not attached to gender? So a lot of it, I think for me too, has been a journey to sort of figure out yet again who I am in the world and how I interact with other people, which I feel is going to be a lifelong lesson for me.
That was Jory Mickelson, author of 3 books of poetry. The subject of this conversation, All This Divide from Spite and Dival Publishing, Picturing from End of the Line Press, and Wilderness Kingdom from Floating Bridge Press, which was the winner of the High Plains Book Award in Poetry. Jory has received awards and fellowships from the Academy of American Poets, the Lambda Literary Foundation, Deer Butte, the Desert Rat Writers Residency, the Helene Wurlitzer Foundation of New Mexico, and most recently, the Sitka Center for Art and Ecology. They live and write amid the moss and mud of the Pacific Northwest. Look for more information about Jory at mtpr.org. You've been listening to The Right Question. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Chris also engineered this episode. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.